This is Why We Write, a podcast of Lesley University. Each week, we bring you conversations with authors from the Lesley community to talk about books, writing, and the writing life. On today's episode, Lesley faculty member and former Boston Poet Laureate Danielle LeGros-Georges speaks with Richard Blanco, who recently visited our campus. Richard was the presidential inaugural poet for Barack Obama and the youngest, first Latino, immigrant, and gay person to serve in that capacity. A Cuban-American engineer-turned-poet, he is the author of a memoir and a number of books of poetry, including this year's How to Love a Country. Without further ado, here's his conversation with Danielle.
Richard Blanco, happy National Poetry Month.
Happy National Poetry Month to you, too.
Thanks.
The cruelest month, as I say.
Yes, it is. Thank you for being with us at the Lesley MFA program. You have recently published a book entitled How to Leave a Country. This is hot off the presses. And there's a poem in it that I find poignant. And I hope you wouldn't mind reading it, and then we could talk about it a little after.
Sure. Then, como tú. So I want to say something that's really funny because it's how to love a country, but I say the same thing all the time, how to leave a country, which maybe we can get into later.
Did I say how to leave a country? Oh, no.
Do you want to?
Oh, yeah,
I do that. I do that all the time because I think there's something subconscious going on.
Right. Being.
Because in a way, the book is about how to deal with, you know, how not to leave a country, how to leave it, all the rest. So,
wow.
It's funny. I've caught myself to, like, and I wrote the thing. I've done it a few times. So, yeah, this poem is dedicated to the DACA dreamers and all our nation's immigrants. And I arrived here when I was 45 days old in my mother's arms. And I've always identified with the dreamers in that sense of, and luckily, as a Cuban exile immigrant, I had special status. So it was documented and all that. But I often pause to think, what if someone were to make me go back to, not even back to Cuba, because it's not even really sort of going back, a place that certainly may be a cultural home, but is not my country per se. This is a sort of a conversation with them in empathy and in camaraderie and in compassion. And it begins with a epigraph by Roque Dalton, who's a Salvadoranian poet. And it says, mis venas no terminan en mí, sino en la sangre unánime de los que luchan por la vida. My veins don't end in me, but in the unanimous blood of those who struggle for life. Como tú, like you, like me. Como tú, I question history's blur in my eyes each time I face a mirror. Like a mirror, I gaze into my palm, a wrinkled map I still can't read. My lifeline, an unnamed road I can't find, can't trace back to the fork in my parents' trek that cradled me here. Como tú, I woke up to this dream of a country I didn't choose, that didn't choose me, trapped in the nightmare of its hateful glares. Como tú, I'm also from the lakes and farms, waterfalls and prairies of another country I can't fully claim either. Como tú, I'm either a mirage living among these faces and streets that raised me here, or I'm nothing, a memory forgotten by all I was taken from and can't return to again. Like memory, at times I wish I could erase the music of my name in Spanish. At times I cherish it and despise my other syllables clashing in English. Como tú, I want to speak of myself in two languages at once. Despite my two tongues, no word defines me. Like words, I read my footprints like my past, erased by waves of circumstance, my future uncertain as wind, like the wind. Como tú, I carry songs, howls, whispers, thunders growl like thunder. I'm a foreign-born cloud that's drifted here. I'm lightning and the balm of rain. Como tú, our blood rains for the dirty thirst of this land, like thirst, like hunger. We ache with the need to save ourselves and our country from itself.
Mm. It's a beautiful poem, and it's serving as a witness to current political events in the United States, our country, right? And yet it reaches back in time and across geography with a reference to Rafael Dalton, the Salvadorian and political writer. It's beautiful how it is a political poem and a universal poem simultaneously. How did you think about writing this poem?
Well, at first there was that, of course, this happened while during that whole period when they were repeating I forget, I've read it a million times, but there's layers and layers of complexity to the legislation and whatnot.
Right.
And so it's a poem again of empathy. But I also just started thinking about, in a way, this is something that's happening. I didn't want it to be just too specific either, but you're saying it's broad enough, because it's something that we're seeing across the world, right? These movements and migrations of people, displacement of people for various reasons, more reasons that are coming on the horizon as well. As I mean, we start thinking about climate change and all this stuff. And it's always the people caught in the crossroads of some of these geopolitical powers that are sort of creating these migrations. And so that sense of displacement too, right? And so again, even though I feel like I have, of course, a special privilege of also a different time, it was 1968, right? So I just started thinking about those relationships, and then Roque Dalton was, that poem is always something that I've always just admired, and I just, como tú, was perfect. It just came, and that in a way that Epigraph started, that sense of empathy and connection and realizing that my own privilege in a way too, but in the way that I hope is generous and sort of says, hey, I'm right by your side, if not legally, at least in spirit.
Yeah, I think that affinity and understanding absolutely comes through, I think in part because of the literary device you use, like you. Right, it's a reaching out to the other, to the reader, to the person at the margin or at the interstices, the brother and the sister. And I think that's that sense of connection is also reinforced with the use of the word like in creating similes. So one thing becomes another. The poem keeps like transforming, and I think really remarkable ways. The similes are rocking in the poem.
Thank you.
Memory, like. Thunder.
Well, that was the other layering. I kind of wanted to have this folding over of how one image leaps into another and connects to another in the same way that, because it's also like you and like me. So it's like, I'm also saying I'm like you, but you're also like me. So, and how one thing sort of weaves into the next and weaves, how we're all in a way woven. I'm saying this, you're making me think about that as you say this.
Yeah.
And that was a device that was just like, and it keeps the image going, because are we really these separate people, right?
Or not?
It's just, and the language is not separate. It's just sort of
right. One
triggers the other, one triggers the other, and you can't isolate that incident.
Right.
From, we can't isolate ourselves from the things that are happening right here, not only right here, but across the globe, right?
That's right. And our histories are not separate, right?
And especially.
Right. And our borders have not always been the same.
Especially in that region, yeah.
Yeah.
In the southern United States, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really remarkable poem. Richard, in 2012, you received a phone call from the White House with an invitation to write and deliver a poem for the second inauguration of President Barack Obama. You discussed this in your memoir, For All of Us, One Today. I want to note that you were the youngest, the first Latino, the first gay person, the first immigrant to be selected for this honor. What was it like to receive that phone call?
Well, there is, in some ways, it was unbelievable. In fact, I was driving from New York City, I think, up to Maine, and I thought it was a joke. I thought somebody was pulling a prank on me, because you just don't realize, they just call you. There's no application process. You're not a semifinalist. You're not, anything like that, manager. And it's so it was very, it was just so out of the blue. And then the other piece was of it was that they had asked me, like, are you available that day?
Like, let me check my calendar.
Let me move the Queen of England from and the Pope to, maybe we can switch them for later in the week. So it was very cordial, which kind of speaks interestingly to that presidency and to our democracy. It's like, you're not expected to do it because the king said,
right.
You're asked and you accept. So what hit me at first was very surprising after all that, and I Googled the person, I realized it was the person I called from the Presidential Inaugural Committee. I was really overwhelmed by something that caught me even by surprise, this overwhelming sense of gratitude, not for myself or like my honor or whatnot, but this gratitude for my parents, my grandparents, and their insistence on education, all the sacrifices that they made to leave their country, the whole immigrant exile story, and realizing that in some ways, that moment, which I knew was going to be life-changing, was only possible because of them and the decisions that they made in my best interest and in my father and in my brother's best interest for a better life. The quintessential sort of American dream story, right? And I just pulled over at the side of the road and just started weeping. I hadn't freaked out yet. My nerves weren't. It was just this idea of, as I wrote in the memoir, that I realized that this was the fifth act of a play, or this was the continuation of a story that was started a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like that pivotal moment, that threshold was the handing off of the reins of that story. I knew now it was my story to finish writing and maybe, or not finish, but continue adding to it and pass on that story to someone else or many others. So that really caught me by surprise. And then sheer terror. Thinking about what am I going to write about, right? Or how do you even, who do you call?
Yeah.
Ghostbusters? I mean, you can't. I mean, I luckily knew Elizabeth Alexander and was able to have somewhat of a conversation with her over email, but you just don't pick up the phone and call Maya Angelou and prepare notes.
It must have been really challenging to write an occasional poem. I know that this type of poem is not the easiest poem to write because it presumes an audience.
Right. So, yeah, I've had a lot of time to think about that. I only had 3 weeks back then, but 3 weeks they asked me to write 3 poems, actually. So it was a poem a week. And I think there's several layers. I mean, one is that, yes, there are very, very few examples, as we said, and this idea, even in Latin American cultures and Caribbean cultures, there's this idea of declaiming, you sit around and you tell a poem, you're like
the public poem,
a performance aspect to it. So that was interesting. I think the process I went through was really taught me a lot about writing poetry. And everybody would say it's the kiss of death, blah blah blah. Because here's a fundamental thing I learned. In a way, it's not that much different than writing the most autobiographical poem you can. In part, you have to go there. You have to go to those spaces that you don't want to go there because, yes, it's about the occasion, but it's about what you feel about the occasion in between the lines. And the hardest part about writing the poem was to get, in part, that kind of personal, emotional connection. So that, because in poetry, you can't fake caring about something, right? Or not caring about something, right? And the most important questions that I had to ask was like, do I love this country? Does this country love me back? Am I really part of this narrative? And I didn't want to go there, and I didn't want to go there because here I am, right? And I finally had to admit to myself, I don't know. And contemplated calling the White House and saying, I can't do this.
Oh my.
And at least daydreamed about it. I'm not sure I'd be allowed to or would do it.
Yeah.
But that opened up that door. And that's when I put in the more autobiographical elements in there. That's when I felt like this is a poem that I felt I breathed my own voice into it as much as I could. And realizing that yes, there is an audience and there is an occasion, but it's ultimately what your emotional relationship is to the occasion, right? And in a way that the poem is an answer to those questions, right? Not an answer, but a response to that question of do I belong? I just opened it up a little bit more, like maybe like como tú, you know, it became more generous in saying, I want to be one of us through this day, moving and connected, even though we don't always acknowledge it or haven't acknowledged it for centuries. Maybe even though we may not feel part of this, we really have to realize that we are part of this grander whole. And, and so in a poem, that's what it became in a way. And it became completely thematically related to everything I've ever written about, which is about home, place, belonging. And so until I allowed myself to question myself and not, and there were drafts. There were drafts of started with the pilgrims. And it was that disembodied poetic voice that, you know, so that's what in other words, I needed to become vulnerable in the poem. Right. And I think that opened and a knock on wood with the five amazing readers that were my trusted readers at the time. So we couldn't tell anybody what was going on. But I learned that, and I teach a course. I've taught courses on what can we learn from that for our own more autobiographical or personal or private writing. The fact is that we're always writing with a sense of audience, right? That sometimes we forget to consider. Now, audience meaning that in a sense, okay, it's not a million people sitting in front of standing in front of the National Mall, but the idea of an audience that we're always writing with the sense that you are trying to bridge some kind of communication. And how we do that is by instinctually finding something that we care deeply about or feel deeply that we know another human being will. Who does not want to belong? Who does not want to feel a sense of home and security and place in a country? And when those two things meet, I think that's when a poem happens, right? Yeah. And I think we do that even in our most private poems. It's like, okay, so my life is this, but what about my experience in a way is ultimately a shared common human denominator? And you know by instinct, you start realizing, it's also the way you craft the poem and shape it, right? And all the rest. So I think I learned that it's a very similar process, and the biggest, I think, faux pas, or where people, I think, and of course I've had to do many other occasional poems since then because I've been asked to Boston Strong, Freedom to Marry, a poem for marriage equality, another one for Silicon Valley, another one for, and things that I've just taken up, a poem for Pulse, the Pulse nightclub shootings, the Parkland High School shootings. So I've really gotten to love this idea of, how can I, what do I care about, and how can I make what I care about public in a different way that's not just through the eye and the romantic eye and what I feel and like what I think and what I'm doing and what I'm thinking about. And I think it teaches us something interesting about how to make our own private poems a little more generous.
Yes. You become this public poet, a public intellectual, right? In a country that has had difficulty with the notion of the public intellectual. I think this is a really beautiful position to occupy.
Thank you from your mouth to God's ears, because it is a very hard space, and there is an anti-intellectual sort of
tradition,
element in America. Ironically, that may come, I think, from our sort of, even my own sort of family, sort of working class, working class sort of ethic and don't get too fancy for your own pants kind of thing.
Right.
It's sometimes misunderstood, but, and then there's always, then it becomes higher or lower, and it becomes, when you look at Latin American countries, at least in my experience,
right.
I always told my mom, Jose Martí was a poet, an essayist, a children's book writer, a liberator. They call him the apostle in Cuba.
Right.
He's the psychological liberator of Cuba from colonialism.
And when Neruda died, thousands of people, right? Thousands of people went out, right?
It is interesting. I do, and I think we need that space more and more. I don't like to even bring up Trump's name, because I think it's just part of a process of the democracy is going, but we're increasingly getting more complex.
Yes.
And just if you see a pendulum swing of what just happened, right, in these 3 years, from one president to another, That says a lot about, we're going through some growing pains and some complexities that we need popular intellectuals that can reach across,
yes,
across all classes, right? Across,
yeah,
all diversity, all, yeah, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
We're nodding here, like.
Yes. So you're catapulted into this civic, public sphere, and then you have the nerve to entitle your most recent book, How to Love a Country. That is a bold title, which suggests an imperative. This is how one does,
right,
it. But also, I think, suggests a question. How does one love a country? Or how does one love this country? So, Richard Blanco, how does one love a country?
or how does one leave a country?
That too. That's already taken place,
yeah,
right?
No, so. You hit it on the nose, because that's exactly what I think that title is supposed to incite. It's both a question, a statement, a prayer, a pleading, a how-to book,
yeah,
a self-help book.
Yeah.
I wanted it to ripple with all those kinds of implications, right? And I think that's what I wanted the book to do. So it weaves between very angry poems, or poems that are just really more outright about, or more enraged, or more ranty, shall we say, poems that are then more tender and loving, and thinking, well, yes, this is terrible, but let's go back to that space that we need to go back to, because at the end of the day, there is a very, very strong ideal and institutions in this country that we need to continue to believe in, right?
Yeah.
There's the very autobiographical poems and the perspective of immigrants like my parents, who are still feel indebted to this country for the opportunities that it gave them and gave their children. So I wanted it to be all those things, you know, like, how do I not, how do I leave it? I wanted to go through the whole range of those emotions. And the book is sort of, in a way, organized or structured that way. It begins more in a historical rooting and understanding of, hey, this is nothing new either.
Mm-hmm.
Some of what's happening is absolutely nothing new. It's always been in our history. So let's, to learn how to love a country, you have to also know it, right?
Right.
You have
right.
to, like a lover,
right.
you have to know the good, the bad, and the ugly, right?
Right?
And it's not, so it's not that kind of, patriotism doesn't save a love for country, because you're looking at things blindly. But, and then how do we grow from that to the present issues, and how those are connected, and how can we maybe find a way out, not out of the country, but get back to that space. But it's also, I got to say, you know, yeah, this may be a little far out for me, but all that being said, I think what the book has taught me, this might be the next book, but we're also in a weird way, I think we're in a stage in human history, or the very beginnings of this, in a weird way, the death of the nation state, right? You know, there's
right.
this sense of, how do you love a country and be part of something, but still at the same realize that it really doesn't matter that much anymore. We're a globally connected world where everything affects each other,
right,
in infinite ways,
right.
And even immigration has changed. You know, we're tied through economies, through modes of communication, modes of transportation. I mean,
climate.
That's
yeah.
the big thing. If
yeah.
we don't get our ass together, you know.
Yeah.
All bets are off. And
right.
so there's this organic narrative that's sort of decaying at the idea of the nation state. And what's the knee-jerk reaction to that? Things like Brexit, things
right.
like our current president, I guess, right. going back to an older narrative
right.
that's saying, no, we're not like that. No, we're separate. We're autonomous. There is no, the sea's not going to rise on this over on U.S. coast.
Right.
It'll only happen in Mexico.
Right.
So in a way, the book is also a farewell,
yeah.
in a weird way. And I think that's where I try to end the book, is like, it's great to belong, but it's also time to let go, or not like not necessarily let go, but evolve that sense of what nationhood means to us individually and us collectively. Because, you know, pride and traditions and patriotism would be beautiful, but it also would be very limiting as
right.
the world gets more complex, right?
So you just made a statement that this is possibly connected, these ideas are possibly connected to the next book. So where have you written a poem or two, or where are you going?
No, I haven't. There's always what I call a curlicue at the end of every one of my books.
Yeah.
It's like usually a book that needed being a poem that probably needn't be in the book, but it's kind of my little like curlicue. And this book ends on a poem called "Calm Until We Are Clouds," and it's this idea of thinking about, shall we say, until we're clouds tear like bread but mend like bones. Mm-hmm. And it talks about not a simplistic idea of nationhood, but the idea that it is a complex weaving in and out, and there are storms and there's things, but at the end of the day, it's one thing and one organism. And thinking about maybe ways to have a conversation about nationhood and politics that become this more on a this very figurative metaphorical plateau of, I guess, in a way, sort of a little Neruda-esque. You're thinking about, and you're making me think right now on this spot, which is great. I love it. Like, but just maybe that's the thing. How do we let go of a country? But for that, you need a different kind of language, right? And I think the book ends in a whole different kind of language.
Which is a really beautiful segue to my next question, which is switching gears a little bit and getting into a poetry, geeky, languagey kind of space. You do a lot of code mixing.
Yeah.
Mixing of words, phrases between two languages or language varieties. You do some code switching from one language to another to create a special effect. You write bilingual poems.
Yeah.
There's one I'm especially curious about, a poem entitled Habla Cuba Speaking.
Sure.
It's a bilingual poem of 8 stanzas, 4 in Spanish, 4 in English, a stanza in Spanish followed by an English one, which serves as a sort of translation, with the exception of one stanza.
Right.
In it, the speaker considers himself, had he stayed in Cuba, here you are the other son. I'm wondering if you could read portions of it, including those stanzas that include those lines, and then talk a little bit about it.
So, shall we begin?
Start at the top and then maybe.
Okay. So, habla Cuba speaking. Aquí eres el otro nieto. No se te olvida el nombre de tu abuelo, ni sus cuentos entre los naranjales, el perfume de las gardenias, en el jardín de tu abuela, sus ojos claros como ópalos que ves en el oscuro de tus ojos. Here you are the other grandson. You don't forget your grandfather's name, nor his stories among the orange groves, the perfume of the gardenias in your grandmother's garden, her hazel eyes like opals you see in the dark of your eyes. Aquí eres el otro hijo. Conoces tu madre como niña barriendo su piso de tierra, y tu padre cortando caña, bañándose en las zanjas del valle. Eres monte entre los montes, una décima entre guajiros, ola entre olas que nunca llegó a otra orilla. Here you are the other son. You know your mother as a girl sweeping the dirt floor of her home, and your father cutting sugarcane, swimming in the valley soils. You are a mountain among the mountains, a décima among guajiros, a wave among waves that never reached another shore.
Richard, Richard, you have entre eres monte entre los montes, una décima entre guajiros. And the English, we are awaiting the English translation, right. And we get, you are a mountain among the mountains, a décima among guajiros.
Right.
Richard, what's going on here?
Interesting choices, right? You know, that was something I really butted up against in this poem. So there's certain words that I refuse to translate, and that's where you see it in other poems, are it's peppered in primary English text, or a poem that's just conceptualized and originated only in English. And the Spanish are just those words again that are so culturally rooted that I can't translate them. Mm. Or they're also sound bites in a way. They're a poetic device just to, if there's a narrative about a big Cuban meal, family gathering, well, you want to hear a little Spanish too, right? So in this case, I butted up against, like, I refuse, I can't translate those two words ever. Like, guajiros, there's no, it's like country folk, or like, you have to say something like, it's just ingrained into the culture. And décima too, which is a form itself, a syllabic verse improvised that comes from that is sung widely in the country, 10 syllable lines. And I could not do that. And I did probably make some more compromises in here than I usually would, in terms of, just because I didn't want to, none of this, I mean, more that I did translate mm-hmm. versus not translate. But this is something that no one would ever know as a reader. So what this poem is really not necessarily a translation. It is, I should have written a note on some of these poems. This is something I like to do with my language. I try to do one of these for every book somehow. Mm-hmm. It's actually co-created. So when I go to a Spanish speaking country, I start thinking in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And then I get very inspired in Spanish, and I'll pen a few words in Spanish. Then I'll translate it. Like this one, I wrote the first stanza, then translated it to English. Mm-hmm. Rewrote the English as I saw fit. Reverse translated to Spanish. Changed to Spanish.
Wow.
Translated a second time, and back and forth until I'm satisfied that I have said what I need to say in both languages as best I can. Then I'll move on to the second. And like, so the poem, that's why I present the text merged together, because it's really not a poem in its translation. Though at the end of the day, it looks that way, and no reader would ever know otherwise, right?
Including me.
No. Of course, it's like, I should put a note on some of these poems, because it's the reflection of the bilingual mind. It's code switching at its ultimate.
Yes.
We're always looking
how
to say something in the best languages that we have when we're bilingual or trilingual or whatnot. And that really, it's also a reflection of my culture, right? We live in both cultures at the same time.
Right.
So I can't always separate the languages. And I get so tired of speaking English sometimes.
Yeah.
Especially when I've been like at a school visit or something for a long time.
Yeah.
And then my mind will just go into Spanish. I won't speak it, but in my head, I'll just be like, my Cuban is like, no quiero en mi inglés.
Okay.
I'm just like thinking to myself, because my mind needs to just have that other piece balance it out.
And it is a lot of work to always think in a language that I think that is not sort of one's original or one's most comfortable language or most easy language.
Yeah. And even, you're making me think as you say that, even though I was obviously, I don't consider myself a Latin American poet. I mean, it's a whole literary tradition. And
right.
How dare I even begin to think about that? But one of my dreams is to write most of, like, maybe Cuba, if I could, and write a poem, a book of poetry that just, maybe that's the next book, that just begins, that is written in Spanish first.
Yeah.
For that, I would need a year of just exercising my mind and reading more of my Latin American poets and stuff like that. But you're also making me think that I've always thought I'm more comfortable in Spanish than in English and Spanish, and that's not necessarily true, and depending on different occasions,
right?
And you're making me think that that's part of, like, in social atmospheres, sometimes English can be much more formal, mm-hmm. and there's always a little bit of a wall or an impasse. I may think in English, but I make love in Spanish. Mm. I cuss in Spanish.
Yes. Yeah.
With Spanish, it's the opposite. It's hard for me to discuss complex ideas. And it's more of my cultural, my family language,
right.
my grocery store language,
my
mother language,
if you will.
But I never thought about how uncomfortable I can feel in English sometimes.
Yeah. So I'm interested in how you think about structure. You have written in your memoir, I discovered that language had to be engineered in a way just like the bridges and roads I was designing. So you did the good Caribbean boy thing. You became a doctor, lawyer, or engineer.
Right.
You became an engineer. So here you have this profession as an engineer saying that language also has to be worked in particular ways. You write in free verse. You write forms. I've seen pantoons floating around.
Right, right.
You write prose, the prose poem. Though I think always, or often, I think often privileging the story, narrative. But I'm curious about how you think about structure. Do some structures impose themselves? Do you sometimes decide that X poem is going to take X shape or X form?
Yeah, outside of a traditional or fixed form like a pantoum or something, like sometimes I just feel there's a subject matter that it really relates to, and I'll try it that where form fits function, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Like what I'm talking about somehow has a justification for using the form, not just out of the blue. And sometimes those poems work out, and sometimes they don't. I think there's one villain now in the third book that's about, it's called Love Poem According to Quantum Theory, and this idea that there's equal and opposite versions of me in equal and opposite universes. And so I thought the repeating line was something interesting to play into that. So those are interesting things, are the form that this is, or made up forms like this, this sort of bilingually created poem to me is a form in a way. I guess I'm always looking, I think it's a lot of more of the math, not the engineer as a career was, but so much math that you're constantly trained to look for logic and pattern and, pattern, logic, structure, and then breaking it.
Right.
So I'm looking to form my own, my own scaffolding to then pull it down, right?
And like every good poet does, right?
And that's what I'm saying. And I think that that's the way I'm able to sort of process it in my mind in terms of those language, in terms of that kind of vocabulary. But I think we all do that in some ways. We're building some kind of structure or parameters. And this is one of the hardest things to teach students, especially with free verse, is that there has to be some kind of parameter, not about parameters you have to create. And it's what's great and horrible about free verse, because right. You got to do it for every single poem. It's
right.
Got to find its own internal logic,
right.
And you got to find it and then break it and break it in a way that it gives a payoff.
I found my experience of your poems is that there's many of them are stories.
Yeah.
Sometimes we fall into a vortex, like Komotu,
right.
As in the case of Komotu. But often there is a linearity, it seems to me. You seem to me a storyteller.
Yeah.
You know, in verse.
And
there's that long sequence in How to Love a Country.
Right.
I don't know, there seems a long line, a length to.
Yeah, I think that's partly. I thought about that too, and then every once in a while, there'll be, like you said, a breakout poem that'll be more lyrical or mm-hmm. less. Of course, there's always a little bit of like a subtext that's a narrative, right?
Right.
But
right.
I think it comes. I think culturally, in a way, too, whether you we're storytellers, like
right. Yeah,
like I mean, one of my favorite things is I remember growing up is like. Everybody eats, you make coffee, you all sit around just tell stories there in Cuba, especially all the neighbor when we go visit, like the entire neighborhood comes over, we just sit around telling stories, gossiping, remembering, telling when this happened, and you're used to like this idea of storytelling, but also in the way that even my first book was really motivated to tell the story, the emotional story at least of my generation as a Cuban American bridge generation. My professor Campbell McGrath always taught me this idea of being an emotional historian.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, the storytelling is by telling the stories of our lives, other people's lives, of communities' lives, that storytelling is a way of documenting.
Absolutely.
And when you feel the other, or when you are engaged in wanting to be the other, in my case, wanting to be Peter Brady because I didn't know any better.
Right? I wanted to be Peter Brady. You know,
and then later I wanted to be Marcia Brady, but that was a little bit later. And I think you start naturally questioning all narratives, right? It's like, well, what's that story? And what's that? And why did they get that story? And why do we have this story? And then at some point, owning that and honoring it by moving forward the story.
One more question. Our Lesbian University podcast is called Why We Write. Richard Blanco, why do you write?
The mic, drop the mic. you know, it's interesting. I've always battled with that. Let me give you the answer first off. I write because every time I write something, I learn something new about myself, about the world, about someone in my life, about history. I'm addicted to that discovery. And I feel like I have my fingers on the pulse of life in the grandest of ways and sometimes in the smallest of ways. If I don't learn something new in a poem, I don't think it's a poem. There's that adage of like, because I have to or I need to. And that's, I get it, and that's great because I am addicted to writing poetry. But it also, I think, gives a wrong sort of romantic impression of writing that, oh, I'm driven by the gods to write poetry. When I love the idea of I choose to write. Yeah. I think that is such an important, in a way that making that choice is so powerful.
Right.
Because we can just, most of us can spend much of our lives not challenging ourselves in any way. And we'll be fine. Right. I mean, in some ways, you know, like, but the idea of sitting down and choosing to investigate yourself, your world, and the people in your life and the people around you, making a choice to me is a more of a powerful statement than saying that I have no choice, that I'm compelled to do that. But definitely why I write is, as I said, I have to learn something new. It just blows my mind each time because it's like, who wrote that? Mm, who taught me that?
You did.
And then it's your part of you. That part of you that's connected to the eternal, right? That we don't, the mystery of wherever, however it connects us to ourselves, our inner selves, and the world itself.
Thank you so much, Richard.
This is wonderful.
Thank you for listening to Why We Write. For more information on Richard Blanco, including a link to his lecture at Lesley, head over to our podcast page. The link is in the show notes. Next week, you'll hear more from Danielle as she interviews Joel Christian Gill, a graphic novelist and illustrator who has written a number of books on uncelebrated narratives from Black history. Here's a clip from that interview.
I want to tell a story. And I feel like that's what makes us human, is telling stories. And I feel like if I can tell these stories to make these stories known, to tell people what it's like to be who I am, to think the way I think, then I can make a difference. That's how I always tell people I'm a cartoonist who's trying to change the world. And I think I can do that with one story at a time.